disposer, it is so bad. That had been open in the refrigerator for 6 months, which is something that we found the other day in the back of mine. Let it sit in there for about 35 or 40 seconds. Now, what is happening is that the wine is actually going into the future.
Or it's going back to its original state, though.
Well, no, it's aging.
I heard about that through the grapevine.
You may have heard about that through the grapevine. And then you can pull it back into real time, and it will win any wine tasting contest you ever had. Now, they, you know, the folks in the wine industry up in Northern California will hate this little device we have here. But the wine is actually aged because in physics, the dynamics of physics, you can actually break down the space-time continuum.
I'm sorry you didn't bring a sample along tonight, Bill.
No, I kind of keep that one under wraps. It's in my mind.
It's not under wraps now, Bill.
No, it's not under wraps now.
Well, thank you very much.
But that can be done, and so the physics of what you're talking about is a part of the world we live in.
Yes.
All right, Al. Thank you.
Pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Okay, Debbie.
Hi. Basically, the reason I called was to talk about some premonitions I have is probably the best word to use. I frequently have premonitions that have to do with people passing away when they die or when they're about to die. Most of the time it's been family, but sometimes it's been total strangers.
You're quite normal.
Well, I have a lot of trouble dealing with it because I just wonder why I always have to get premonitions about death. The other thing is my aunt died about 3 years ago. And my whole family seems to have some kind of, if you want to call it psychic ability, to be able to see people from beyond here, beyond life as we know it, and whether it's heaven or otherwise. And I felt very badly because my aunt and I were very, very close, that she hadn't come to me and went to Palm Springs with my husband. And was laying there in bed and said, okay, it's time for me to see you. I think I'm ready. And I closed my eyes, and I'm assuming I had an out-of-body experience, or began to, and got scared. I was afraid she wouldn't let me come back. And those fears really bother me.
You had an out-of-body experience?
Yeah.
I am the only one in town that cannot do that, you know.
Well, it's the first time it's ever happened to me.
At least you had the first time.
But I didn't know how to deal with it. I was afraid that when I went through that door, I wasn't going to get back.
Okay, so you were afraid. It's interesting. There are a number of things you described in what you just said that gave a sense of losing control. I was afraid that I couldn't get back. I don't know why these experiences of premonitions of death have to happen to me. And if you think about the experiences as something that happens to you from without, as something that overpowers you and that you have no control over, that can be very frightening. But in fact, you have a lot more control over your experiences than you may think. And you can choose to not have certain kinds of experiences. If you actively decide that you don't want to pay attention to information about death, thank you, then that's something that you can actually make a decision, a quiet kind of decision where you really tell yourself, please no more right now. It's interesting that once people realize they have that kind of control, then they often decide, well, since I'm not out of control here, I think I'll have the experience. Also, you can learn to focus your experience in a positive way on other sorts of things. And that's why I like to work with the general public sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can focus your experience in a positive way and learn about how you can use your abilities in everyday life and not just when something so overpowering as a death in the family comes in.
Well, I had, which a couple of the experiences have been not bad experiences. These are, the people are coming to me to tell me that they're okay. Okay?
Good.
It's basically, I mean, it's almost like I'm getting this so that I can tell the people that are left here they're all right, they were happy, it didn't hurt, whatever. That doesn't bother me, okay? The fact that I can go to them, the response of the people to me when I tell them, well, they were happy, there was no pain, they look at me like I've got four heads and I'm strange.
You've got to use great discretion in who you talk to there.
Well,
great
part of it was my family.
You know that.
The only one I know who
can get by with it without using discretion and tact, Debbie, is me.
Oh, okay.
Because I just do it anyway.
How do you, I mean, I was in a sound sleep at our previous residence, which was an apartment building. This was a few years ago. And was awakened by the smell of, strange as it may seem, yellow roses.
Why did you know they were yellow by the smell?
This is what's very weird. The gentleman that lived across the hall from us was an alcoholic, and he also had an awful lot of other problems. He came by my door once, a long time prior to his death, and said, "Oh, my God, your husband gave you yellow roses. May I smell them? They smell so different than red ones." That was the night he died. I woke up smelling yellow roses permeating my room, and it was the strangest thing I had ever... I mean, why would I wake up and say, "I smell yellow roses"?
Was that the night that he was in there talking to you about yellow roses?
No, this was months after it. Months after it. It was very strange because he and I were not close. We passed each other in the hall, said, "Hi, how you doing?" You know, no major friends. It was just passing acquaintances.
Does it help you to know that this is not an experience that is unique to you, but that millions of other people have had similar experiences, and you're not going crazy likelihood?
No, I know I'm not going crazy. I'm thoroughly aware of the fact that I'm not. It's just...
Or you may be going crazy, but this isn't an indication of that necessarily.
Well, I mean, I don't think I'm going crazy is what I should have said.
Well, I think you're going sane myself, and the whole world is crazy.
I would just like to be able to feel some of the... I mean, if something good is going to happen to somebody that's still here, you know, instead of feeling the good that happens to someone who passes from this life to the next.
You know what I think would be very good for Debbie? And Keith is... going to be down. You're going to be in this area in September with a workshop, aren't you, Keith?
Yes, I am.
Tell us the details, because this is the kind of experience, Debbie, that you and your friends would want to come to.
Okay.
All right?
I found that people really want some personal time to work on their own psychic experiences and talking about that, and also work on developing their own psychic abilities without a lot of dogma attached, in a really sane kind of way that brings the scientific information across in a way that the layperson can really relate to and experience and work with. So I've been asked to come down here in September and possibly after that, working with UMS. You can call the UMS Center in Los Angeles at 434-3453, and the UMS people will give you all the details and tell you when. It's very important to me to work with the public, because I want to know what people are experiencing, and I also want to bring what we've learned in the laboratory to the people on the street who really need to know. For example, you need to know that you're not going crazy, and also to try to make some sense of your experience and to get a sense that this is not just something that's happening to you, but this can be a positive side of your life. I can't answer all of your questions. I wouldn't pretend to. But we can certainly work with things like out-of-body experiences and remote viewing in the same kind of way as an alternative to a lot of the other kinds of information that's out there, which can be really confusing.
If I come down there, can I go out-of-body?
You can't. We can work on inducing out-of-body experiences, and I can show you the techniques. Now, I can't. We don't even know if an out-of-body experience is, for example, leaving your body. And the reason we don't know that is we don't know if you're in your body to begin with. I was talking to a...
You sound like my program director.
Well, a neuroscientist at MIT recently, and I just said, "Look, have you located consciousness in the brain yet? You've been doing this research for God knows how many years, and you're one of the leading scientists in the field, have you?" And he said, "Absolutely not. We haven't located consciousness in the brain, and we don't really know where that comes from or what's going on." So for me to say, can you leave your body? I would be making a lot of assumptions, but we certainly can explore the experience in a very personal level.
You know, Bill, there's a lot of techniques people have developed for leaving your body. The one that's most effective in that as many as 50% of people have an out-of-the-body experience is to almost die. However, I don't recommend the technique because the almost part is tricky.
It's a tricky part.
It's nice to be able to work on that experience.
Keith's method's safer.
Yeah. In a positive way without having to have an operation or a car accident in the process. Yes, I really think so. Okay.
Does that help you, Diane?
Diane.
Yes. Debbie.
Yes, thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
Debbie, appreciate your call.
Okay.
And you're right on target, so don't worry about it.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back in a moment. My name is Bill Jenkins. But more importantly, we have Keith Harari here along with Dr. Charles Tart. We're talking about a power that a lot of you don't know that you have, that has been talked about in a very mystic way, but because of the work of Keith and Charles Russell and so many others, we're looking at it from a laboratory point of view, from a no-nonsense scientific point of view, that it is there. And so it's now time for you to start dealing with it in a very real way. Ron, you're on.
Yes. Bill, thanks. Dr. Keith, appreciate your time. I met a man who claimed to be a clairvoyant, an automatic writer, and a healer. And when I expressed my kind of skepticism about the whole matter, he, with dramatic results, showed me that he actually possessed some kind of power, starting with witching for water.
Dowsing.
And my relationship with this man progressed. And we went on to ultimately discuss guides. And is that a person or an entity that you know of?
Everybody seems to have their guides.
Yeah.
Who will openly talk about these experiences. They just seem to be a rather consistent part of the litany.
It's an interesting kind of phenomenon, and you wonder there going on. Is a person describing some entity? Or are they describing some part of their own mind, some way of communicating with themselves by objectifying a part of it? We don't really know.
Can you hang on, Ron?
Sure.
We've got to do something, and I want you to stay on hold. You've waited a long time. Good mind on this Saturday night, and we're here to stretch yours a little bit. It's time to kind of give your reality box a shaking out, if we may. The old reality box. And to help you do that is Keith Harari and Dr. Charles Tart. And Dr. Tart has a marvelous newsletter. I love it. It's called The Open Mind. I'd like to read what you said about the open mind, Charles. Again, you did it earlier, but there are a lot of new people with us at this hour. The open mind is curious about all sorts of things, has an intelligent confidence in itself based on self-knowledge of strength and weaknesses, wonders what's beyond and behind the everyday world, enjoys using its powers, testing its limits, and adding knowledge and skills, can take intelligent, calculated risk for the sake of growth, cultivates sensible doubts and grows from them, realistically recognizes current weaknesses and limits, but seeks to grow beyond them, appreciates living in a marvelous, mysterious universe, constantly seeks increased self-knowledge. On the other side of the coin is the closed mind, is dulled by habit and fantasy, is insecure or unrealistically confident based on illusions about itself and stifling of self-knowledge, guards and reinforces the borders of the everyday world. We might add, jealously guards them.
Right. Shouts heresy when anything different happens.
Uses its powers to defend its current reality and fears to test its limits. Avoids risk or takes foolish ones through lack of self-understanding. Avoids doubt by mental rigidity or poisons itself by useless doubts. Denies weakness and limits and or takes them as absolute and unchangeable. Love it. Fears what is not understood and tries to inappropriately control life in itself. Wants only knowledge that is pleasant. Well done, Charles.
Which one are you?
I hope that I'm on the left side, the open mind side. And
which one are your listeners? Which ones are your listeners? That's the question. I think that's beautifully said by Charlie.
I do, too. I appreciate it. I'm going to frame that.
Yeah. Now, of course, we all wobble back and forth between those two sides. You know, there are moments we're more often and moments we're more closed. And sometimes, actually, that's a natural part of growth. You kind of open up, take in a lot of new stuff, and it's sort of scary in some ways, so you back up a little and get conservative, but then you digest, then you open up again and keep growing. It's a natural movement.
But you know, one of the encouraging things to me, Charles, is when we started doing this show back in 1979, we felt we had two chances at this, slim and none. And it has been moderately successful. No, it's been very, very, very successful. Because this audience out here wants to know these things. I think that you're finding people are more and more looking for a chance to be open-minded. Now, they may not use that
people really do
rhetoric.
Want to know. That's the whole reason we're
really
writing this newsletter, to try and get this latest scientific knowledge about the mind right out to people directly instead of going through
and they can't get it anyplace else. You know, it's not in the Los Angeles Times, or maybe there will be an item there not fully done back on page 34. It's not dealt with that often here at KABC because we are, you know, very involved with the things we do, and we do them well. So we have this little niche, this little Saturday night niche that is all ours. And you will find that this is a very open-minded group out there. Now, we get our skeptics.
Good.
And I love to have them along. And we challenge their mind, and they come back and challenge us every now and then. And that, of course, is always a delight to me, to see that the minds are working. If I challenge, if you challenge Charles, if Keith, you challenge somebody out there, and they are motivated to the point that they'll get on this phone and say, hey, you've challenged me, and I think you are wrong. Well, I love that.
I love getting under people's skin.
Yeah.
That's okay.
That's what it's all about. I sometimes get worried because there's not enough challengers that come on. It sounds like I've, you know, rigged all the calls. But that hasn't been the case at all. But it's a case for open mind. It's a case that it does work. The interest is there. And I think that this show kind of even proves that, that the interest is there, although we deal with many subjects. But we're always kind of out on the vanguard.
Bill, this may be off the wall, but what you've said has just given me an intuitive feeling to share a little technique I've developed for opening your mind.
Okay.
It's a technique I call experimentally believing something. You know, usually we either believe something or don't. We don't know why we believed it or not why we disbelieve it. But it's real interesting to just say, okay, for a day or an hour or something like that, I'm going to believe something all I can, and then I'm going to see what happens. So, for instance, you're going to go take a walk for an hour downtown. Try believing that people are basically rotten. That, you know, underneath a surface politeness, they're really awful. And look around and see what you can see. And then for the next hour, say, try believing people are really pretty great underneath the sort of gruff surface. And look around and see what you can see. You can discover how much the beliefs you have influence what you see. And then you can ask yourself the question, well, what is it I do believe and what are the consequences on me?
Oh, they influence what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you touch.
Make an experiment out of what you believe instead of just taking whatever you've been given by society.
You realize you're doing that all the time.
I saw the most incredible example of this the other day. A dear friend of mine came over to the house where we were experimenting with a whole new type of sound. We call it optophonics. And it's a hearing experience that is like the way you hear. It's not stereo, it's not mono, it's the way you hear. And let him listen to just a television show that we had recorded off of Channel 7, the Liberty Weekend. Magnificent in the room, right? He says, I don't hear anything. It's, you know, it sounds like hi-fi. Just didn't hear anything. Now, we've had sound engineers and people, you know, what they're hearing is quite unique. And worked with him a little bit and found out that he used to be a musician in a band, and some time ago he had decided that hi-fi was no good and that stereo was a gimmick, and therefore he had never even bought a hi-fi or stereo set because it was all bad. And he had changed his consciousness and his mind to the point that he couldn't even hear that. We worked with him a little bit, gave him some earphone techniques, and he went back out and listened to the optophonics again. And it was a whole new world for him. But his mind had literally shut down his eighth auditory nerve.
Now, that happens with psychic experiences as well.
Right.
And, in fact, bringing people into the laboratory sometimes to use certain techniques that we've developed over all these years of research is like helping them learn to listen. The sound is there. They're just not hearing it.
That's right.
Somebody might say, well, what good is it? Who needs it? Right, in the Valley of the Blind, they would say, why open your eyes? Who needs it? And besides, it might be an invasion of privacy. And in fact, it turns out that you can see a lot more of what's going on around you and connect and communicate better. And it's very interesting that people, in order to feel more secure, sometimes close themselves off from things that might be really wonderful experiences and that might ultimately make them feel better about themselves. It's a kind of resistance.
Exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And in order to have these experiences, you have to rely upon more than just your biological being. And I'm including the human brain or mind or whatever you want to call it. There's a lot more to what goes on between your cranium there than the cells that are up there. There is a spiritual intelligence that is very actively at work.
We might say there's some space between the ears.
There certainly is between these ears. I know that. Or at least I hear that. Some people are four-space, you know. I don't know what happens in that space, but one of these days we'll fill in the blanks and something interesting may happen. Oh, my guests are Keith Harari, Dr. Charles Tart. I want you to read your creed for us, Charles.
Yeah, this is an example of a belief experiment I use in workshops sometimes in order to remind people of the beliefs that have been foisted off on us simply by being part of Western culture, whether we wanted them or not. And I'll just read a couple of paragraphs of it and understand I get people in a workshop to really decide ahead of time, I'm going to believe this all I can, and then I'm going to see what happens as as my emotions react to this. And it's very educational. I call it a sadder but wiser experience, actually. And I'll just do a couple of paragraphs of it. But you, the listeners, might say, okay, I'm going to believe what he says for a minute and see what happens.
I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want the listeners to also believe what I'm going to do here for a second, and then we'll get into your creed.
All right.
It's 17 minutes. Sorry. Okay, Charles, give us the Western creed.
Okay, as I say, try believing this and see what reactions it has. You only have to believe it for a couple of minutes, then you can go back to
it. We are in an experiment. We are going to believe this.
This is the experiment, right?
Go through all of it.
I believe in the material universe as the only and ultimate reality, a universe controlled by fixed physical laws and blind chance. I affirm that the universe has no creator, no objective purpose, and no objective meaning or destiny. I maintain that all ideas about God or gods, enlightened beings, prophets and saviors, or other non-physical beings or forces are superstitions and delusions. Life and consciousness are totally identical to physical processes and arose from chance interactions of blind physical forces. Like the rest of my life and my consciousness have no objective purpose, meaning, or destiny. And jumping a little bit ahead, I maintain that the death of the body is the death of the mind. There is no afterlife, and all hope of such is nonsense. Now, in radio, we can never have dead air, but take 2 seconds to just notice your emotional reactions to this. And I'm purposely cutting it short, because the whole thing induces fairly powerful feelings in people, and I like to be able to work with them.
It does. I don't believe a bit of it, but and have a hard time believing it. But on the other hand,
everything I've said here you can find repeated over and over again as supposedly scientific fact in every scientific book you're exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
That's the picture that's being taught to us by the high prestige priests, as it were, of science about the way the universe really is.
And you wonder why there's such a runaway cocaine and drug problem in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
People are searching for some way to fill that emptiness, and they know that there's more. They know that there's more, and they're being denied any way of getting at it. And so they're taking
some... People keep saying this is it.
So now what do? They look for a technological solution. Pop a pill, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Smell this. Put this in your arm.
Buy this.
Instant pudding, instant enlightenment. Instant death.
Escape.
Escape into what?
To death.
And that's the irony, because it's death that is really scaring people and making them wonder what the heck is going on here and what life is about. And to escape from thinking about it, they get there faster.
That's a powerful thing, Charles. What you just read and what you just said.
And I want people to understand that's not what I believe.
Well, we know that. No.
And it's funny, nobody joins
hey,
my
if you
cult.
Believe
after
that,
I
you'd be out of the street here. You're in the wrong studio. But But for that.
Yeah.
But
what it
is,
turns out when I do this is that people discover that while intellectually they might say, no, of course I don't believe that, emotionally they realize they believe a lot of these things because they're Westerners and it's been drummed into them over and over again.
Oh, there was some terribly ghost truths that came rollicking out of the words that you just said, and you skipped some of them.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's too powerful to do the whole thing over the air. I want to be able to work with people when I do it.
The interesting thing is,
save it for workshops.
You find yourself...
Could we write you and get a copy of it?
You have a copy in your hand.
No, I mean the audience. They may want to have a copy of that for a grounding reference.
Then. I'm planning on writing it up in either the next or the next after the next issue of The Open Mind. I want to put it in context.
How does someone get a copy of your newsletter?
Yeah, if people want to write me for subscription information, they can write me at the Psychology Department, University of California, Davis, California. And if you want to be efficient, the zip is 95616.
I bet they know where the university is up there.
Yeah, I think just Davis will do the
job. Davis will just do the job. That's a good one just to ground yourself. Look at it. And then take your little experiment. I'm going to believe this for 2 minutes. Chances are you can't get through with it.
Well, if you can't get through with it, and yet that's the reality that we're all pretending that we're living in, there's a real problem. Because if we can't get through it, then we don't really feel that way, but we're acting like we do. There's a lot of pain there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of emptiness, and there's a lot of need to acknowledge and explore something deeper without fear that somebody's going to think you're crazy. You're not going to be taken seriously. So by using science, which is really the language of this culture, we can... look at this in an objective kind of way, in a scientific kind of way, understand and still make that available to people on an experiential level. In fact, in a certain sense, science is meaningless unless it impacts people's lives directly in some way.
That's right.
Now, Keith's right, but we have to use real science. See,
that's right.
What we think of as science is often not science, because real science is curiosity. Real science is a way of always being open-minded and looking at things.
I like that word.
But people are human. So they often get attached to the particular things we know at the moment. And what you get instead of science is what I call the religion of scientism, where there's things that have been discovered that have to be defended against error. And scientism is what's really influenced us, the idea that we already know so much that we can dismiss all these
things. Well, that becomes dogma instead of discovery.
Yeah, it becomes dogma. Real science moves you into something like parapsychology or altered states research that reminds us, hey, when you really get curious and look, the mind is open. There's all sorts of possibilities here. These other things, these physical laws, sure, they're true in certain limited ways, but they're not the whole picture.
Well, we find in the world of science, and we touch on that quite often here, and it's one of my favorite little things, that you look at all of the laws of physics that are laid down, first and second law of thermodynamics, which, of course, we now know is not true. But it was if, somehow or another, we were fingered by God on stone and given to Moses and came down off Mount Sinai.
You know what Robert Oppenheimer said about science? In something called The Open Mind, incidentally, written in 1955. Yes? How about that?
How about that?
He said, there is no place for dogma in science. The scientist is free to ask any question, to doubt any assertion, to seek for any evidence, to correct any error. Where science has been used in the past to erect a new dogmatism, that dogmatism has found itself incompatible with the progress of science. And in the end, the dogma has yielded, or science and freedom have perished together.
And there are forces at work working for the perishment right now.
I'm afraid so. There are forces that would say to you, we would like you, we insist that you view reality in our way, and we do not even want you to explore certain questions. And they do that in the guise of protecting you from your own curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
As though you don't know what's good for you, as though you can't look at the information yourself and decide what it means to you. They're going to tell you, in fact, they're going to prevent you from getting that information.
However, their days are numbered.
Yes, I hope so. And I think that the public is ultimately too smart for that, because this is not something from outside of people's lives. People are having their own intuitive, psychic, you could say spiritual experiences. I know there's more going on here than meets the eye, and I like to spell that with a capital I.
Mm-hmm.
There's more going on here than meets the eye.
Right.
And you really can't fool all of the people all of the time.
You know, our problem in the human situation was described very nicely by the poet William Wordsworth in his Intimations to Immortality. He said, "There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth, and every common sight, was covered in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream." He was talking about childhood. He was talking about the fact that we're born wide open. We're curious. We find the world wonderful, and we look at things. But then he has to talk about what's happened to us by the time we're adults. And he says, "It is not now as it hath been of yore. Turn wheresoe'er I may, by night or day, the light which I have seen I now can see no more." We go through a terrible process that compresses us down, that closes our minds, that inhibits our very curiosity, our very zest for life. That's what we have to get away from. And, of course, that's what's exciting when we have these new discoveries in new areas of science, parapsychological stuff, earth we live in. And I'm fascinating and interesting. We all are.
We all are.
And
we
life, all is, are. Life is short, so why not go for it that way?
And if we start using these new discoveries, we start then improving the quality of our interrelation with each other and Mother Earth and all things in between. And life becomes much more fascinating then.
I mean, again, to go back to the belief experiment, try for an hour walking down the street to believe other people are dull and uninteresting. And then try for the next hour. Every person I see is a marvel and a mystery. See what happens.
The sun will be brighter. It certainly will.
I think you've tried it.
I've gone through. I've seen that movie, and I liked the first one much better than the second one. I'll be right back in a moment. It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkinson. We only got a half hour left here. You know, we just all sat down here a few minutes ago.
Time is funny stuff.
Time flies when there is no time.
Now, Ron, are you still on the line there with us after all this time, because we kind of got it? Are you there, Ron? I think he gave up, because we had him hanging on the line there that we went into the news half hour ago. I don't blame Ron for going away. I would have to. Hello, John, are you there?
Yeah, you got me?
Yeah.
Okay, you guys segued and stole a little of my fire.
Imagine that.
Must be psychic.
But I'll just make my statement and consider me a field reporter from the biology department of UCLA.
Why not?
And I'm a 30-year-old person who went back to college at 25, and I had a real philosophical upbringing and then got into the biology arena, and I'm currently struggling with it because I've just come to a sort of a frazzle point. And what I've discovered, having had to go through it myself, is that the UC system couldn't be more gold foiled around the edges with authority and prestige, that the parents of the society have relinquished and sent to their children to these schools to be taught Darwinian and Lamarckian theory of random collection of carbon and nitrogen, that is who you are, and that this is a fact. And it, close scrutiny shows that, in fact, the fossil record is very incomplete, and thermodynamics and the organization of DNA fly right in the face of the random collection of these things and so on. But the debate aside, the premise that is taught, the idea that you're just this random collection of these basic molecules, is in fact not. And then this is what is taught. Okay, so given that, when you come out of this thing, you've had to memorize and take these tests for years, high school, college, and so on. So this is ingrained into your mind. It is the brainwashing.
John, I'd like to look at the whole idea of randomness. I think that we don't necessarily perceive any underlying organization that might be there in nature. The idea that there is such a thing as a purely random event, there might be, but what we call random may not be random, because it may be organized in a way that we just can't observe, we just can't see, we can't tell what's happening.
Right. Well, that's true. The reality box is drawn such that the causation is outside the reality box.
We don't see what's really going on.
That's right. Well, but the point is, what I'm saying is, with the doctrine that is given, and I mean, I have challenged these professors head to head, the doctrine that is given out, and I mean, you have to memorize this stuff, you have to read these books, you know, you're going to get your grade, you're going to move up the ladder, you got to do this, so that it is ingrained in your very philosophy if you don't have any other going with it.
Indoctrination is the right word for it.
That's right. It is brainwashing, and I used to not believe in that, and I'll tell you what, after having to pass these courses, I believe in it, because it has twisted my mind to have to resist this and then somehow get a degree at the same time, and I'm changing my major because of it, because I just can't, I'm frazzling. But anyway, let me make my point. So I'm painting with a wide brush here because obviously an individual like myself is pulling out of the system. But in general, and this I'll lead this to the business question that Bill was raising, that you're given this education and this you are just this random, spontaneous, no organization, no higher consciousness assemblage of these molecules, and that is what you are. And in fact, the selfish gene theory predicts that your body is merely a vehicle which the DNA uses to perpetuate itself. So
that's even more great, doesn't it?
Okay. So if you take this thing, now the other problem also is that these schools are in fact not silent on the question of religion. Biology and the and this is where biology deals with this creation business is in fact a religion, and you mentioned that it's a quasi pseudo religion that does not have or is it a pure religion of posing as a scientific fact, and it is completely antithetical. It cannot work with any spiritual viewpoint at all. There's no way they can work together.
Well, I have a little something to add to that, if I may.
Sure.
Interject, John. What you were talking about, it's right in line with what we were talking about. You're talking about the DNA molecule and its randomness. I want you to read some of the writings of Dr. Crick.
I've read his original book. It is the most organized molecule that
right.
one could... It's the amount of organization and the sophistication of DNA
right.
and genetics is...
Did you read his conclusions?
To me, it is... I've read Thomas Jefferson on the issue of creation.
Well, there are two things. Get back into Dr. Crick's writings and go to Jeffrey Goodman, for instance, who wrote a marvelous look at this called The Genesis Mystery.
All right, let me think.
Great book for you to read.
Okay, well...
And also, and be with us next week. But Dr. Crick and Jeffrey Goodman and some of the other men of that area, we've been talking about this random arrangement of the DNA and the appearance of the Homo sapien or the human being, says it did not happen by terms of evolution, but there was an intervention of some kind in the processes of all other living organisms.
I've always been interested in the busts of sort of fossil skulls that you find in the Museum of Natural History in New York, and they're carefully structured so that you can follow the evolutionary chain, following how this one subtly changed into that one, and that one subtly changed into this. Oh, yes, and you can see the cheeks are here, and the mouth is there, and exactly what the expression is.
That's a man.
And in fact, a lot of that is guesswork.
That's right. They'll find a tooth and reconstruct an entire body from a tooth.
Sure. And then find out that they're dealing with several different animals there.
Yeah. Now, another interesting thing that's interesting, and I'll just throw these up. How much time do I have, Bill? Because I got a big...
Well, we got a bunch of calls, John, but
okay.
I certainly want you to make
okay.
a point.
Well,
Can I go back to his previous point first? John, I really want to compliment you because you've taken a major step forward. You've realized that you're not just getting an education about facts, you're getting an indoctrination, too.
Yeah.
And it's not even a conscious indoctrination, you know.
Right,
those professors are not thinking we've got to indoctrinate this student. They've been indoctrinated.
It is contagion of error.
Right. What would really be needed in a more enlightened society would be for those same people to say, here are a collection of observations people have made, and some smart people have interpreted them this way. We'd like you to understand that, but you're not required to believe it, and we encourage you to think of your own interpretations. That would be real openness. But you've recognized the problem. So much of the time, when people say they're teaching you scientific fact, they're actually teaching you their philosophy of life without even knowing they're doing it and implanting in you as brainwashing, as indoctrination.
Good Lord, I had a professor at Duke. While I was at Duke University, I had to keep secret the fact that I was also working in the psychic research laboratories. And I had a professor at Duke who, after I graduated, and he had told me that while I was an A student in his class, and he wanted to get together and talk all the time, that was fine. And he said, you know, definitely let me write you the highest recommendation for graduate school and maybe you'll come here and work with me. When he found out what I was working in some of the laboratories there, even one of them on campus and in the engineering department at Duke, but not in the psychology department, he saw me on campus one day and he said, don't come near me. Don't touch me. How do I know if you're real or not, or if you're even standing here? He acted so irrationally. He acted as though I were some sort of early Christian coming in to wreck the Colosseum in Rome.
I upset
his reality, and his reaction to that so obscured any sense of rationality that I really wondered what he was getting at, and I was certainly glad that I was already, I already had my degree.
All right, let me wrap this up with this, and this goes right to what you were saying, Bill, with selfishness and so on. If you play, in other words, if I'm going to become an accepted pillar of society, I'm going to go to this college thing, and this is, you know, I was 25, I'd been a blacksmith all my life and worked very hard and didn't even complete high school, and I thought, well, gosh, I'm nobody, I've got to go to college. So that's why I went, because I wanted to be a pillar, and I was just working for a living, just a blue-collar person.
Hey,
so,
let's take the just out of that.
Well, I've just, well, I was, I'm being
good for you.
I've realized the error in my ways. I shouldn't have gone to college, but anyway, you can always tell a high school graduate they're illiterate, but...
Try talking to a PhD lately?
Yeah, right. Anyway, the point is...
No offense, Charlie.
If you look, PhD stands for proposal digger. If you look at the governmental advisors and the business MBAs and the people that are shaping and molding our society, the international bankers, these people are all products of these colleges. And you take this materialistic point of view from them, and they complete, it's like Pentecostals call it the spirit man and the material man. And you leave out that spiritual aspect and the moral, ethical, because, you see, there's nothing wrong with profit, in my opinion, or doing anything, but this do unto others as they would have do unto you, to borrow a phrase, speaks of a spiritual higher order that one recognizes in preference to this material immediate gain, so that I'm willing to, for the long haul gain in a spiritual universe, I am willing to say, hey, wait a second, all right, I'll sacrifice 10 cents because I wouldn't want to pay that much myself.
But you see how we've changed that? You use a beautiful accent, do unto others as you would have them do to you.
Yep.
Jesus taught that, but it was certainly a part of the litany long before Jesus.
Yeah,
but we've changed that. Do to others before they do to you.
Today you do lunch.
Yeah.
Do lunch. So I think that the nub of my point, and I'll get off the line and let other people go on, is that the very problem here, and I think that I am an optimist, an eternal optimist, because I think that the homeschooling will rectify this. But as long as the universities are allowed to have this position of respect that they have with the philosophy they're putting out, and they are putting a philosophy out, they are not null on this position, and this separation of church and say that's a bunch of baloney, that the schools are a church in themselves, as long as they have that position, we're going to have a society that is corrupted from the very basic unit of, you know, a unit being the person. And I think this, what I've been looking into here is this homeschooling and church schooling and various denominations of churches, that people are pulling their kids out of these drug-ridden, pregnancy-infested schools and educating their kids. And as soon as there are tax credits allowed so that people can get a tax deduction, maybe with the new tax legislation they'll eliminate the possibility of that. But as soon as people can take their bucks out of this school system, we're going to see a revolution where these tenured professors who have got their head in their socks, they're going to be fired so fast and sent hiking to get a real job that that'll be the best thing that ever happened. So I would encourage people to remove their children from these schools and give them a true a spiritual, and whatever your spiritual focus is, as long as you have a moral basis of ethical code of conduct, I say more power to you.
You know, an education is a very important part for all of us, and how we get it is our own intimate personal responsibility.
If somebody was armed when they went into one of these colleges with a good, and that was my benefit, I have studied a lot of philosophies, Eastern philosophies, Christianity, Scientology, I've been through a whole Nietzsche show, I've been through a whole raft of them, and I came into this biology thing and chemistry and physics with a very philosophical outlook. So as soon as I saw the fact that supersymmetry and superstring theories in mathematics predict a 12-dimensional universe, I said, hey man, that is God. That is something funny going on.
Yeah.
I'm living in Flatland. And I went to my professors with this and the other students, and it's like, you know, Twilight Zone. These people, because I fortunately had a philosophical background.
Okay, John, I tell you, you've made your point.
Hey, great.
Appreciate it. And for getting in there with us.
Hang in there.
You bet. Bye-bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's open mind. Robert Oppenheimer was using it years ago.
Back in the 50s.
Yeah.
Maybe coincidence with a capital C. Maybe it's time we need more open-mindedness.
How do we reach you?
Right. People who'd like subscription information on that can write me at the psychology department, UC Davis, Davis, California, 95616. And do write rather than call. I'm working on some writing, and I'm not answering my telephone this summer, but the mail will get through to me.
I know you're hard to get to. Okay. Patty, you've been waiting for a long time. Get on there.
Well, thank you. I sort of got in on the tail end of this show, but because you're getting...
Where were you?
Well...
Don't answer that, Patty.
I should have been listening from the beginning. This show is the light of my life. But anyway, since they're psychical researchers, I had a psychic experience, and this particular kind of experience is very unusual for me. It's not a common thing with me, and I want it understood also that I have no control over this ability, and that also and that it's not common.
We'll hold that aside for a second. You feel you have no control. You believe you have no control.
Well, consciously, I don't.
What kind of experience is it?
Okay, well, the reason why I wanted to share it is because it's a little bit similar to what that woman was mentioning earlier, except that I have a hunch it's related to the concept of soul family. And I was wondering if you know anything about the concept of soul family, and if so, if you think it might be related to that. What happened was, in the late 60s, it's the same with me like with the other woman. I met a man, and this happened to be, the only reason I feel it's all right to mention who it is now is because the person is deceased now. Otherwise, I wouldn't, you know, reveal this information.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. And the person was Steve McQueen. And I only, because I had a boyfriend, and his brother was very good friends with Steve McQueen, so I was introduced to him. And we only had said hello, and we were just introduced, and that was it. So I didn't see him more than 1 minute.
So what happened?
Okay, what happened was, after he passed away, I saw his soul in my apartment looking at me. And as I said, I have no control of it, and this is a very rare thing. I mean, it's not a usual thing with me. I'm not that way. And I saw it looking at me, him looking at me. I guess it was his astral body. I don't know what term you would use. And
okay, now what is your question?
Okay, well, my question was here. I only said hello, and I didn't know him, and he came back. And I'm just wondering if they think that maybe this happened. I'm just trying to clarify and try to understand this experience a little bit more, why it happened. If they think maybe because he was part of my soul family. I don't mean soul mate now. I mean soul family, and there's a big difference. And that's why he knew of me.
It sounds like you've already answered the question in your own mind.
Well,
I don't know what do you have to say about that, Keith,
okay.
That particular experience.
Well, obviously you felt this personal kind of connection. So when he died, you had an experience that related to your own feeling of a personal connection. It's very hard to objectively and scientifically analyze that kind of experience. I can't give you an answer, especially over the radio. You're just sitting there and telling you, well, this is obviously what that means. We have to know when we don't know. And it would be, for example, I could say to you, typical clinical psychology thing to say, I would just say, well, you know, maybe you imagined the whole thing, and then you would say, oh, no, I didn't, you know, and I would say, well, of course, I have no way of knowing that, and it would be totally unfair to say that, because your experience is real to you, and how do I know what was really going on there?
But I have a suggestion for you, Patty.
Uh-huh.
You know, you've called before, you had a similar experience with Marilyn Monroe, and you've called at another time, and you had a similar experience with other well-known people. Now, you need to start investigating that in your own mind.
Sometimes people... It's an interesting kind of thing about celebrity in this whole society, that we invest certain people with this power of celebrityhood. It's like royalty. And if we ourselves feel a little bit like we're not worthwhile, if we can connect ourselves in some way to someone who is famous, they know us, we have their autograph, we've talked to them, you know, whatever... then we become more special. In fact, you're special being who you are.
Well, no, I really...
It was interesting what you just said, Keith. Liza Minnelli said it a couple of weeks ago on television that after that Liberty Weekend, the American Broadcasting Company did how people respond to stars, you know, the big stars, like the ones that Patty is talking about. That's the closest thing the American people have to royalty. Are the big stars in whatever field they may be in, not necessarily just show business. And you do connect in that way.
Well, I thought maybe, you know, there was a spiritual relationship. That's why I said soul family, because there's a kinship. That means
kinship. But you've had so many big stars that you've been connected with.
Well, maybe I was connected with all them. Well, you heard Lee Sung. He said that he told me that Grace Kelly was reaching out to me when she passed away. That's what Lee Sung said. I wasn't saying that. He said that.
Lee Sung, is, for those who don't know, is what Patty was talking to. He is an entity that comes through Alan Vaughn, who was a trans medium at that night. But
okay,
I think
we're all connected.
Yeah.
I think we're all connected to each other, and we don't need to look to a special celebrity to be connected to. I think that we can get much more security out of realizing that there is some underlying connection between all of us that we don't quite understand.
Does that help you, Patty? Because we got to go. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
You betcha. And if Greg, you can make it quick, we'll try to get to it before we have to leave, okay?
Okay, Bill, I'll make it as quick as I can. Real quick to your panel, I enjoyed the show tonight.
Thank you.
I too have had psychic powers. This is the first time I've said anything to anybody. Basically, my two questions are, how can I improve this into better use for myself, to improve myself? And what are some exercises I can do in order to make it stronger?
Number one, go to Keith's workshop in September.
I plan to.
And answer the next one, gentlemen.
Well, first of all, know that you don't have to follow some dogmatic belief system to develop your own abilities. Mm-hmm. They're right there, and it really involves learning to recognize certain kinds of information, to separate that from what I call mental noise, which is the wrong information, the analysis, the guesswork. When you're trying to get an intuitive impression, there are very specific ways to recognize that and to work with those impressions.
Right.
And you can get better with practice. It would be very difficult to tell you that in 2 minutes over the radio. It takes a whole weekend. It took 60 pages in the Mind Race to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not a mysterious process. At the same time, we're still learning more and more about it. And it's complicated, but it's not that difficult.
Mm-hmm. Keith, is your wife or the girl that's with you, is she blonde?
Yes.
Okay.
Is my wife, and she is a woman.
Okay. No, while I was on hold, I had a vision of that, and I just wanted
to... Hey, listen, five stars. She's very beautiful.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
And Keith, thank you for coming back to Open Mind. Dr. Charles Tart, it was so... delightful to have you there. Best of luck with the Open Mind, the newsletter, and all of the work you're doing. Next week, Drs. Lee and Vivian Gladden will join us, and we'll take a look at the heirs of the gods and what's come out of that. So you be with me. Till then, good night.
KABC.
You'll find around, so come on in and join us tonight on Open Mind. And that window between physical life and spiritual life is found in the physical presence of one Thomas Jacobson, who is our guest tonight. Thomas, welcome to Open Mind. So glad to have you aboard.
Hi, Bill. It's great to be back.
Hit the red button over there. I can tell. There you go. Say it again.
Hello, Bill. It's great to be back. Thank you.
All right. Thomas is a transmedium, and for those of you who don't know what a transmedium is, I think it would probably be better for it to be explained by Thomas.
Okay. Mediumship is a term that I like to interchange with channeling, because channeling infers perhaps a little more of creativity, and that helps people understand, I think, how they are a medium, how they channel. And I like to encourage everyone to begin to contemplate how they are already channeling, regardless of your belief system or your doubt or your skepticism. And what I went through, it was basically surrendering to natural communication deep inside myself, which means allowing myself to become more sensitive and much more receptive. And it was definitely the most difficult thing I've ever done. I'm still doing it, of course. Mediumship is someone who's in the middle between two or more points of view, and offers themselves as a channel for those varied points of view to make contact from one person to another, or from one reality to another reality. And of course, the job of a medium is to build and maintain an exceptional degree of objectivity. One thing that I think some people take from that is that means that the medium or the act of mediumship is not creative. And so I like to emphasize that the act of mediumship for you, for everyone, for myself, is highly creative. And that's the state of art and creativity and invention that we've all seen.
Well, I'd love for you to get into that, because I am persuaded, and this has taken a long time for me to understand channeling and mediumship. I think that everybody does it.
Right.
You do it every day.
Yes.
I was talking to a dear friend of mine, who's an attorney friend of mine. In fact, he and I are doing a lot of client relationships these days. And I'm reading some of the things that he wrote about the particular matter that we're dealing with. And they were just beautiful. And he was looking to me, and I said, Andy, you're a magnificent writer. You know, where did you come up with all of this? He says, you won't believe it. And I said, try me. He says, I just sit down and these thoughts come into my mind. They are things that I never heard of. Quite often on the floor in a courtroom, he says, I just know that if I open my mind, that these things are going to be said that he didn't think about.
Right.
That are very much on target. He is very, very successful. And I says, Andy, you're channeling.
Right.
Exactly. And then I had to explain to him what channeling was.
Right. The experience of channeling is so natural that it's like breathing. So it's something we really haven't thought about. And what happens is that all of us get pictures in our mind all the time. All of us get these thoughts, just like the lawyer, who come in, that come into us out of nowhere. However, we have a very deeply ingrained habit, it seems, of priding ourselves on our ability to discern, our ability to judge, and so most of what comes in, we toss out. And each and every minute of the day, we have this flow of pictures and thoughts coming in. And what we do out of our fear of failure and errors or being naive or silly is we reject probably 99% of it.
Well, I think we probably have to put a little ego there, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the hard part of the reason that channeling can be the idea of channeling can be very effective and practical for people is to invite themselves to really surrender to the thoughts that come into their mind and let them come out, externalize them outside through writing or talking or whatever before they judge it and quit trying to decide what's right and wrong before it's even brought to the outside world.
Well, let me stop both of us here for just a second. Let's assume that there are people who've tuned in with us tonight on Open Mind that have never been here before. And we're talking about channeling as if it's something that everybody should know. But if you're from Central Texas, you may think channeling is going out there fishing for catfish.
Right.
That's not what we're talking about. Channeling is, correct me if I'm wrong, receiving information which is beyond your consciousness.
Correct. I agree.
And it manifests itself in many different ways, whether it is writing or just thought processes, or in your case, you're a trance-channeled.
Right.
And you will, for the audience, you'll be able to experience that with Thomas tonight, where he will go into trance. Let's describe that for again.
Okay.
You're just going to kind of go away.
Right.
And if the audience could sit here and watch you, you're going to look funny.
Right.
All right. Because your configuration
better.
No. No. With all due respect to Dr. Peoples, no, you don't look better. But you have now gone, and you've gone into an altered state of consciousness.
Right.
And at this point in time, then another consciousness is going to occupy your being for a while, as far as we're concerned.
Right.
Now, he's going to twist your face up a little bit.
Right.
But he is also going to be able to say some things that are quite unusual. He will talk much different from you do. Now, when you've had this checked before, your physiology changes when this happens.
Right.
Your EKG changes. Is that correct? Your changes.
Yes. It slows down quite a bit, just as Dr. Peoples comes in, and it takes on a very, very even rhythm, as if in deep sleep. Although it is distinctive from deep sleep, it's something fairly unusual.
Well, we've, of course, had this is, I don't know how many times you've been on. You're one of the more popular things that happens on Open Mind. But I want to prep the audience as to, you know,
right,
what's happening. Thomas will go into trance a little bit later, and Dr. Peoples will present himself. Now, when Dr. Peoples presents himself, he takes over Thomas's own physiology. He has his own way of doing things. I lose control of the show when Dr. Peoples is. I really do. But we love him. He will give us a metaphysical preamble of some kind. Have you talked to him about shortening?
Yes. He's heard this over and over again, but I doubt it'll do any good.
He's going to say those things, and they always are very rich, and they're very rewarding. A little background on Dr. Peoples, if you will.
Well, he presents himself as a gentleman, elderly in years, as a human being, and born in Scotland and raised in England, and lived most of his life in the United States, and was an author and traveled the world lecturing, which I didn't even realize, by the way, at the beginning.
Well, I didn't either, but we did some research on him after our first meeting, and sure enough, Dr. Peoples exists, and we even had a photograph of him.
Right. I had two or three different books sent to me that he'd written I didn't even know about, and he was talking about spirituality when he was in the body, which was a mild surprise to me.
Yeah, he was a clairvoyant.
And
quite renowned.
Yes, right. Yeah, he was lecturing when he was 100 years old around the world. So he comes through, and what I do is relax into a type of sleep, a trance, where I give him full permission to occupy me. And he comes through strongly and presents his point of view. Their desire is to share their philosophy. That's what they like to do. And then they answer questions and try to wrap that philosophy around the questions. But he's very sincere, and his desire is just to serve and to help people. He comes through. Every time I've gone into trance, he comes through for a moment. Sometimes he doesn't stay in, but he's usually there for quite a while. And I think everyone will find him very colorful, but I feel so lucky and blessed that he's coming through me, because I just love him a lot. He's quite something. He has quite a sense of humor.
Well, we all love
his philosophy. Is quite unique.
You know, your last appearance, and Dr. Peoples' last appearance, was one of the most uplifting, one of the warmest things that have happened on Open Mind, because he is humorous, but he is very real. And he gets right to the point of the matter with the person with whom he is talking. And what I have found is interesting, because you've gone into trance, you know, privately, or in our own social group,
right,
rather than on the air. And he can be in a group of people, and he will talk to, say, Annette here sitting here. And he's saying one thing to her, but to all of us that are listening, It's another thing.
Right.
Together. There are multi-levels in which he speaks.
Right, so everyone gets some meaning from it, usually.
Right. And this is true with the audience. You know, I'm listening, and it seems to be kind of very, very general, but I have had so many of the people that Dr. Peoples has talked to, and she'll call me, you know, during the following week, says, he was on target. He knew everything that was going on, and I'll go back and listen. And it was kind of general things he was saying, so there's a double-barreled shot happening.
Yes, because what I've learned is he is trying to wrap that philosophy. He's trying to answer the question in a way that not only helps that person, but can be somewhat meaningful to anyone else listening, to help them learn to answer their own questions, so to speak.
What I would like to do here, I'm going to take a little break in just a second, right, just in a moment or two, but I want to open up the phone lines for you to talk to Thomas Jacobson, who, before he goes and lets Dr. Peoples take over the radio station, which he will do, and find out and answer any questions you may have about mediumship and how he got into it, what he feels is the importance of it to you, which is very germane to why you're here with us tonight. I think it is something for you to explore and to open your mind to, that this is going on around us. You will hear, of course, an outstanding example of that tonight with Thomas and Dr. Peoples. Not all of us can do that. I think all of us could.
Absolutely, yes.
If we gave it an effort. Let me give you the numbers. They all end in talk. And let's get into that. I think it's important that you understand that goes on, and that you understand that it is indeed very much a part of your own life, because Keith Arari is here. We will have Dr. Peoples, I think, in November. He will be here live and doing all of his marvelous wonder things along with Thomas Jacobson. But we wanted to talk about something a little more where you're coming from, I think. And that is where we, as
human beings, all of us are coming from. We are beginning to learn in this little, what we could call this, our own little symposium that goes on every Saturday night here. Has been going on for many, many years. We're learning a lot of different things. And one of the best voices, one of the best educators we have, are the men who wrote a book called The Mind Race. It's a must book for you. Go down to Alexandria, too, you know, just talking about them over there. Get your copy of it. It's written by Russell Targ and Keith Arari. And Keith is with us tonight. Keith, welcome. Welcome back to Open Mind. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Now, Russell couldn't be here tonight, but you have a fill-in, which he'll work, I suppose. You want to introduce your friend to him? And give us a little bit of his background.
Charles Targ is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis. And Charlie has been in this field for a very, very long time. Wrote the book Altered States of Consciousness. And how many other books have you written, Charlie?
Several. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yes, and dozens and dozens of articles on psychic abilities and really helping us to understand our potential. And now he even has a newsletter on the subject.
I really do like the newsletter. I really love the title charge. Charles, where'd you get that title?
I just thought it up.
You just thought it up.
It's picked called it out of the air, as it were.
The Open Mind. I knew I liked you from the very beginning. You know, we were thinking together. Gentlemen, can human beings actually do all of the psychic thing that we talk about that in the world of mysticism, bend metal, see at great distances, see into the future, see into the past, know things that they're not supposed to do? Is this a part of the human consciousness, really?
Well, if you throw all of that together, then you kind of have to answer them one at a time. Human beings clearly have much greater potential than we thought that they had. For example, people can learn to accurately describe information at a distance. Mm-hmm. You can sit here in this studio, or your listeners can sit at home, and accurately tell what is going on in some other place. The next room, or someplace in China, someplace in some other part of the world. People can even describe hidden objects in locked boxes. You could describe what's going on in the Soviet Union in some place. People are also able to describe what will happen in the future, what hasn't happened yet. You ask a question about bending metal, and I can't answer that question because much, much more research has to be done to see whether that is a psychic effect or if that's some kind of unusual psychological effect or what's going on there. What we do know is that ordinary people can learn to use their psychic abilities.
Mm-hmm.
They can learn to do what we call remote viewing, which is this ability to describe distant locations or hidden objects or hidden information, even distant people, accurately.
Well, I find, you know, particularly with the, you know, the appearance of both of you here, that we have taken it now out of the realm of the metaphysicians talking, the lecturers lecturing that this can be done. You have been involved deeply in ongoing, rather significant research that is showing this that this can happen. And by significant research, we're here in California. We kind of think Stanford University is a neat place. They work pretty good up there. They do a lot of good stuff. And you know the halls of Stanford rather well, don't you, Keith? Charles?
Well, Charlie and I were both at SRI, which was formerly Stanford Research Institute.
Right.
And is now called SRI International. It's a think tank. And we were there, in fact, working in psychic research.
You have a lot of people who have a lot going for them, that have a lot of very important things to do, and they were dealing with this subject. Does that lead us to believe that perhaps there's something to it?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt to it, Bill. I mean, sometimes people ask me if I believe in psychic stuff, and I tell them it's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of looking at the evidence and seeing what's real.
It's like saying, do you believe that Dallas is here? You know, if you don't, it goes away? No, it's here.
That's true. Actually, I've never been to Dallas, so I can't be 100% certain.
But I've been there.
Oh, good. It is there. Okay.
It's there. In fact, it's interesting that people often talk about psychic abilities as a matter of belief. Oh, do you believe in that? And, well, do you believe the sun comes up?
Yeah, that's about it.
And you would say, Well, that's not a matter of belief. The sun does come up, sort of. I mean, it looks like it's coming up. Well, people do have the ability to describe things psychically, to have psychic abilities. People can learn to develop that. The exciting thing is that we're not talking about special, unusual, weird people off in one corner someplace who are doing something psychic at SRI or anyplace else. I'm talking about your listeners. I'm talking about you. I'm talking about all of us. People can learn to develop their psychic abilities, and you don't have to join some cult, and you don't have to buy into some belief system. It's kind of like learning to play the piano.
Probably easier.
Probably easier, yeah.
Much easier, because we can do these so-called psychic things, or these weird things, and we probably, in a very benign way, are using them all the time anyway.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think that psychic ability, something like clairvoyance, is actually the mechanism by which mind and body connect with each other. You know, mind always seems like something different from your body and brain, but when people have tried to think about it, they say, well, if they're different, how does one work the other? And I think we have enough evidence for psychic function to say, what's its normal use? And I think its normal use, actually, is that it takes the part of us that we vaguely call mind, that's somehow different from matter, and it's the communication link. It's the mind somehow perceives what's going on in the brain and the nervous system through a kind of clairvoyance, and then somehow affects the nervous system and our body through a kind of psychokinesis. I think, actually, it's such things that you know at a distance or the like, they're unusual uses of psychic ability. Normally you use it inside all the time. Once in a while, you see it out there in the world, and that makes us notice it.
Well, what I love about the work that you're doing, and our good friend Russell couldn't be with us tonight also, is that we have taken it out of a realm, we've put it into the laboratory. We have examined it with the best kind of laboratory information that we can examine it. We have put it under the most rigorous kind of testing that we would expect the people in the medical profession to put on the virus that's causing cancer or AIDS or whatever. We're now dealing with this particular
thing. Medical research is real sloppy by the standards of parapsychological research. We have gone overboard on being rigor and airtight.
So what there has been rigorous research.
It's actually the rate of repeating experiments successfully in psi research, psychic research, called parapsychology, the rate of repeating experiments successfully is higher than in many simply broadly accepted psychology experiments, that when you go to do them again, don't really repeat that easily. You can check that out with a lot of undergraduate psychology students who try to repeat those experiments, and they don't work as often as many experiments that we do all the time, for example, remote viewing. I was involved in an experiment a short time ago in which a woman in the Soviet Union was asked to describe where I would be in San Francisco 4 hours in her future, 10,000 miles away.
I want you to hold that story, because I have to describe something in the future of everyone.
Okay.
All right. But I'm glad you're getting into that, because as was outlined in your book, The Mind Race, that there is a lot more to psychic phenomena than looking into crystal balls, and it very well, and in fact is, tied in with the very defense of the American way of life. Back, I'm Bill. And we are talking about where we are. Can I be poetic there? Where we are, really, are psychic individuals. We're using our psychic abilities all of the time in, well, some perhaps in more dramatic ways, but have you ever had that hunch that lets you do something? It's a hunch.
It's interesting how people use the word hunch,
mm-hmm.
and they use the word gut feeling.
Right.
Men use that. Women say women's intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone says, oh, I was just lucky. Sometimes that is luck, but sometimes it's more than that. You might have a friend who somehow always finds a parking place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wherever it is, that friend is always just, you know, they know where to go, and they're there. What is that? Are they just lucky? Are they somehow or other psychically homing in on that? We have a lot of sort of cultural jargon, words that we throw around for intuition. Intuition, ESP, hunches, gut feelings. But, in fact, psychic experiences are not just confined to the laboratory. They're widespread. And in traveling all over the world, I found that all kinds of people want to talk to me about what's happening to them. Once they find out that, I will not think that they're going crazy just because they describe a psychic experience, a precognitive dream, for example. I started to tell you about this experiment between the Soviet Union and the United States, in which a Russian woman working with the USSR Academy of Sciences was asked to describe where I would be in San Francisco 4 hours in her future. 4 hours in her future, 10,000 miles away. She was in Moscow. I was in San Francisco. I did not know where I was going to go. We were completely out of touch with one another. She was being filmed by an independent American film crew and by the Academy of Sciences over there while she did this remote viewing of trying to look into my future. She's, of course, never been to San Francisco. She hasn't been out of Russia, as far as I know.
Probably won't let her out if she has all that ability, come to think of it.
Well, it's a hard place to leave in general. But the woman described seeing me in a plaza in what she called a cupola, a curved building. She saw animal ears and animal eyes. She gave other good details. Animal ears, animal eyes, a cupola in a plaza.
She knew about San Francisco.
She knew that it would be someplace in San Francisco, but, you know, how many places will fit that description? Now,
there's animal ears all over San Francisco,
right? Yeah, that sounds like San Francisco to me.
She even drew this profile of an animal's head with the ear and the eye, very specifically. It turned out that 3.5 hours later, I randomly chose a place out of a pool of possibilities that only I was aware of, randomly chose a place so that even I did not know what was going to come up exactly. And exactly 4 hours later, I was sitting on the merry-go-round in the plaza at Pier 39 in San Francisco. And sitting right next to the horse's head with the animal ears and animal eyes, and, of course, the curved merry-go-round building. And this was a Russian woman who was really not that different from you or I.
Now, she had her vision of where you were going to be recorded 4 hours ahead of time.
Correct.
She had never been to San Francisco.
That's right. And
I didn't know that there was one of these little merry-go-rounds going around.
In fact, the merry-go-round had been recently moved out to the plaza. And I chose sites for my pool of locations that were not going to be popular, well-known. I did not choose the Golden Gate Bridge, for example, or Coin Tower, because everybody thinks of that. I chose places that would have unique characteristics, but that you wouldn't necessarily think of. And...
Well, in your book, The Mind Race, there's quite a dissertation you go through about this random selection.
Oh, it's important. In fact, I did not know what she had described. I was not in touch with her. I did not know when I chose the place at random, I did not know what her description was. Otherwise, I could just go find a place that fit that description. My task, should I decide to accept it, was just to be in a place at a certain time.
Sure.
And that's what I did.
And went through your very careful... random scientific procedure to get there.
That's right.
You know, I was very impressed with the work that you and Russell did and how you were so very careful about there is no way that you were going to come up with some sort of a predetermined thing, a way that, oh, well, I know Keith pretty good. He's going to go down to this point, that point. Yeah, you had computers selecting it for you.
That's right.
Where they would do it.
I think that's really important, Bill, the way these random selections are done, this careful control. Because, you know, there's an awful lot of reality subsumed under the word psychic. There's also an awful lot of nonsense that goes under the word psychic. And what I think is exciting in our time is that through research we're beginning to understand what parts of the psychic are really real, that really reflect things that people can do, and what parts are sort of dreams or ideas or illusions that we could just as soon get by.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important to me as a human being, a person who talks about this a great deal, to see the kind of research that you, Keith, and Russell, you, Charles, are involved in under the most strenuous kind of mantle of research, the kind of research that we would expect out of any phenomenon, whether it is medical. Mental science. You were applying those very same kind of disciplines in order to establish that this kind of ability does or does not exist.
I could disagree with you on that a little bit, Bill, in that Who invited you here, Charles?
I'm not terribly interested in establishing that certain kinds of psychic things occur, because I think that's been established so many times.
Yeah, really.
I'm really interested in what works in the psychic things. What are different psychic abilities? And even more, what do they mean? What's it mean that our mind can sometimes reach out and touch somebody else's mind? What's it mean that we can sometimes look into the future? I mean, it's fascinating in and of itself, yeah, but the question of what it says about our human nature is the thing that really excites me as a psychologist, particularly now.
Well, even more importantly, Charles, how can we now put this great ability that we have to work? We have seemingly refused to do it. But if you go back into our history, if you go back into our religions, even, go back to the Bible, indeed wasn't Jesus teaching us to use psychic ability? That was one of his prime teachings. By faith you can move mountains. He was saying that by faith you can unleash the power that is within you psychically.
Well, of course,
to do all kinds of things.
The church for a long time was suggesting that people stay away from this stuff, that it was of the devil, that this is bad material, you shouldn't look into your psychic abilities. And I was speaking with a friend in Italy, works with the Vatican there, a Roman Catholic theologian, who was describing how the church was possibly concerned about competition, prophecies like precognition, miracles like psychic abilities. And if this is happening...
I have some precognition.
All right.
Or otherwise, we're going to be in trouble. I am so involved in what you're saying and so delighted to have you here that I forget that we have to pause every now and then. And do these things, which are precognitive. Certainly they have a lot of psychic sense to them. And they pay the bill.
Jason.
News time. We're on news. This is Open Mind Time. 11 minutes away from the 10 o'clock mark. With me is Keith Harari, Dr. Charles Tart, and we're talking about psychic phenomena, and we want to finish the thing with the Soviet Union and what they're doing over there.
Well, the Soviet Union, and I was in Russia addressing the Soviet Academy of Sciences on psychic research, and the Soviets take psychic research seriously at the highest levels of their government.
And very high of a budget within there.
A lot of money there going into the field. It's hard to estimate how much. I could tell that they wouldn't show everything. Obviously, they're not going to show everything. But there are some secret laboratories over there. They are pursuing the field very seriously. They are repeating the American experiments in remote viewing, not with special, unusual psychic people, but with psychology students. And they're getting excellent results. They're able to learn to accurately, psychically describe what is happening in a distant location, where people are hiding.
Well, there is, you know, we've talked about this before, that they're able to discern a lot of things, for instance, psychically. And we can do it, too, and perhaps, hopefully, we're working on that.
And even satellites can't take photographs inside of buildings, as far as I know. And so you have this time dimension. You have all sorts of blocked information that you might be able to get at, that, in fact, we have very strong data showing that you can get at psychically.
Well, you've detailed a lot of it in The Mind Race, this marvelous book that you've written. It's must reading. In fact, I think for a lot of people it has become must reading. How's the book doing?
It's in about a dozen countries and must be getting close to 150,000 copies, somewhere between 100 and 150,000. I've lost count, frankly.
NASA took your research very seriously?
NASA supported a program at SRI to look into whether ordinary people could learn to teach themselves to use psychic abilities with a little ESP teaching machine. And they found that, yes, in fact, nobody got worse, and more people than you would expect by chance got better.
Can I get one of those teaching machines?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned?
Stay tuned.
We'll talk about it in just a second. Listen carefully. Charles?
Well, I would like to have my hand even higher in some mystic clouds, but only insofar as I keep my feet on the ground.
Well,
and very practically oriented, and I like to not be fooled. That's why I think I get into the scientific side of this, because people can fool themselves a lot about this stuff. And yet if you worry too much about that and don't have anything to do with it, you miss the real gems that are available through psychic kind of work and the spiritual work that psychic work can lead on to.
There is sort of an interrelation between the two, isn't there?
All of the great spiritual traditions used psychic phenomena as a justification for their reality. I mean, they all said, I'm not just talking some nice ideas about what the way the world is and the way you ought to live, but see, I can work some miracles to prove that I'm in touch with a higher power. Of course, all the spiritual traditions have all worked the same miracles, each one justifying its particular one, but that really does tell us that there's something solid behind spiritual ideas. And actually, that's why I'm more interested in the implications of psychic phenomena than the applications. And I think the applications are wonderful, and they can become far more practical than they are now as we research them. But the implications for what they say about human nature is really important.
Well, I am reminded of, about a person who I know was not a scientist. And that was the Apostle Paul. And he was quite implicit, as you read the writings of the Apostle Paul, this information that he got was not from me. No man taught it me. Now, the religionist will tell you that he was getting some sort of revelation from God, but as you look very closely at what Paul was saying, is that where he was getting, or was he actually having a psychic experience that allowed him to touch information it was unavailable to him otherwise?
You know, it's interesting. The church is opening up much more to psychic experience, certainly toward human potential. The Second Vatican Council has said that now they're beginning to feel that understanding human nature and understanding even these parts of it has a lot to do with understanding God, and that we can no longer just push that aside.
And we'll get to that. You stand by.
May I see?
We not only want to open your mind, maybe we will stretch it a little bit, massage it some, and maybe you'll learn how to use it a little bit more than you are right now. The mind is a wonderful thing. It's a fantastic tool, but it's there to serve you. Thank you, it. And to help you with that particular idea, for whatever that might be worth to you, is Keith Arori. This is an encore appearance for Keith, and I love having him on. He's so energetic. Not only that, he's got his beautiful new bride with him tonight. You know, I understand why you married her, Keith. I don't understand why she married you. And Dr. Russell Tart, who has worked very closely with...
No,
Russell's not the one. Charles.
Russell is Russell taller than me.
Russell's the other guy.
Hair.
He's the one with the funny hair, you know, that is here, who I always associate with Keith because, you know, I've had them on a couple of times, and they're two of my favorite people, and I certainly enjoy the work that they've done. Charles Tart. Charles, I love your letter, The Open Mind. That's good. How does someone go around getting this newsletter?
Anyone interested in getting...
You didn't ask me if you could use that name, by the way.
Oh, you'll
I give you permission. Okay.
Anyone interested in information on The Open Mind can write me at the psychology department, the University of California, Davis, in Davis, California, and I'll be happy to send them information.
You know what I love about it, Charles? And you were reading my mind when you put this together. In the front of it is a definition of what the open mind is and what a closed mind is. Would you be so kind as to go through that litany?
Sure. The open mind's curious about all sorts of things. It has an intelligence confidence in itself based on self-knowledge of its strengths and weaknesses. It wonders what's beyond and behind the everyday world. It enjoys using its powers and testing its limits and adding knowledge and skills. And the open mind can take intelligent and calculated risks for the sake of growth, not foolish ones, but calculated ones. The open mind cultivates sensible doubts and grows from them. It realistically recognizes current weaknesses and limits, but seeks to grow beyond them. And particularly, the open mind appreciates living in a marvelous and mysterious universe. Now, the closed mind, on the other hand, is a drag. Yeah. I mean, this list is sort of the opposite of that. The closed mind is dulled by habit and fantasy, running in the same grooves over and over again. The closed mind vacillates between feeling insecure or unrealistically confident, based on illusions about itself and a stifling of self-knowledge. The closed mind guards and reinforces the borders of the everyday world, doesn't want any change, tries to protect them. The open mind uses its powers to defend its current reality and fears to test the limits. Did I say the open mind?
You said the open mind.
I meant the closed mind. The closed mind avoids risks or takes foolish ones through lack of self-understanding. The closed mind avoids doubts by mental rigidity or poisons itself by useless doubts. The closed mind denies weaknesses and limits or takes them as absolute and unchangeable. And the closed mind wants only knowledge that's pleasant. I try to stimulate the open mind in this newsletter. I write about parapsychological things, about spiritual growth and psychological growth techniques. And I try to shake people up a little bit to remind them of what our possibilities might be. Not as dogma. You know, I don't have anything that I want to say, this is the truth, you better believe it. But from my research in this area, I see interesting things happen to keep reminding us that, wow, this mind of ours is incredible, the things we may be able to do. And if you keep yourself reminded of those things, maybe you'll try them. Maybe you'll grow. And maybe it'll be more pleasant that way.
You wouldn't mind if I put this in a frame, your open mind, closed mind thing, and stick them in my office, would you?
I'd be overwhelmed and honored, Phil.
Well, I'm flattered at what you were saying, and I am encouraged by what you were saying. Because that is, although you put it down in a litany that is far more expressive than I'm able to do, but it certainly does say what we're about here on this show. And to find that others are thinking that way, and of course, I know they are, but in such a fine poetic way, I'm thrilled. So I want to keep that.
Okay.
Stick it on a wall. And send it to anybody who wants it.
Maybe even read the material, too.
I certainly read the material. I'm getting where I can just read like you wouldn't believe. I really have to. The world is moving so very, very incredibly fast.
And you have to keep your mind open to deal with it. Well, if you get a closed mind, what you really try to do is make the world stop changing. And you know, that's pretty hard to do. So it's very frustrating to close your mind and try to make the world sit still. It won't happen.
Well, have you noticed that the world is moving at a different tempo now? Of course, we deal with many things other than the so-called, quote, psychic phenomena or human potential. That's really where I look at that. But in the world of science and philosophy, all of these things are coming together at an enormous rate. Now, you and I were having a conversation about the relationship between the spiritual being and the physical being. And we've had many conversations here about, in the world of science, this is also happening. The great physicist of our time, and I'm very honored to have a chance to have an intimate relation with many of them, who were the agnostics, or just the non-spiritual persons altogether, who have become very spiritual, not necessarily religious, but very spiritual in their approach to life, because now they're seeing the physics and dynamics of spirituality and the power of the human spirit being displayed in front of them in their laboratory.
You know, the growth of science in our culture, I think, was necessary because organized religion had become an establishment. A lot of nonsense was in there. Our culture needed to say, we're going to look at everything anew, we're going to throw that out. But I think we've discovered psychologically you can't totally throw out the spiritual. What you have to do now that we have more of a scientific solidity is come back and find out what's real in the spiritual realm, what isn't. To give you an example, all the great spiritual traditions tell us that we're all one. Well, you know, that's a great idea, we're all one. But I like to ask people, do you feel at all one with me or that guy over there or anybody else? And the reality is we don't usually feel like we're one with other people. We feel encapsulated inside our skin. And modern science seems to tell us that's the truth. We're all inside our brains. If that's true, that leads to a lot of selfish feelings. That leads to feelings of isolation. You know, if you're separate from me, what do I care if you suffer? I don't feel it directly. But now along comes something like telepathy that says, hey, wait a minute. once in a while at least, and maybe more often than we think, there's a really intimate connection between you and me. There's a real mind-to-mind joining. Maybe that idea that we're all one is not just some abstract philosophy. Maybe that's talking about a reality, and if that's part of the reality of who we are, I think I'd better find out more about it. Because, you know, if you and I and other people are one, your suffering isn't isolated. Your suffering's my suffering. I'm going to care in a much more intimate way about that. That's why I said earlier I'm really concerned about the implications, because we live in a world where kind of physicalism or materialism has dispirited us very badly, where we think when we die, that's the end. When we're alive, we're isolated. Our horizons are very limited. And then out of science itself, in a strange way, in the science of parapsychology, comes this new scientific stuff that says, wait a minute, you can't limit human beings like this. There are things like telepathy, and we really are connected. Let's find out about that. That, to me, is what's exciting, applying that.
You know, there's some other exciting aspects of it, Charles and Keith, that I have noticed, not only in the world of science and parapsychology, where we would do it, but in the world of business, which I have an opportunity to deal with. The very serious people in business who are moving into the frontiers of the providing of goods and services for us, which is what business is basically all about, realize that what we have been doing in the past is wrong. It's not working. As you look, you see the great financial institutions of our time are beginning to break down. They have to merge or they're going bankrupt. Why? And one of the reasons is that we have taken a very, very wrong approach, a non-spiritual approach. One of the building blocks, for instance, of capitalism, as we have been taught from the time we were children, which is an untrue building block, and it was never intended to be a part of capitalism, that is, for instance, I have this good that I want to serve you here, and I will charge you what the market will bear, and that is good business.
And if you and I are totally separate, why not? What do I care if you feel
that? That's right. But actually, whenever you analyze that particular thing, particularly if what you have is new or it's rare, you can't escape from the fact that charging what the market will bear is a form of greed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is certainly a level that you should charge for this based upon what your costs were and to make a normal profit. But to charge what the market will bear is greed. And greed destroys men and societies and nations. And these businessmen are looking at the very rudimentary elements of the way we do business in the United States and the world over, and they will tell me that we are no longer a profit-motivated society, but we are a greed-motivated society, and there is a profound difference. And the one who is going to be destroyed the most by that is us as a society. And they are changing those thoughts.
There's a wonderful Buddhist term that sums up the problem. It's the term of what is right livelihood. How do you earn a living in a way that's fair to other people, that doesn't harm other people?
Mm-hmm.
And our psychology, our sociology, our science really has to be applied to that. You said it very well. We're driven by greed. No matter how much you have to have more and more and more. And, of course, we're destroying our world that way.
One of the reasons for that is that people feel so isolated. They feel so separated in their own minds. So alone.
Mm-hmm.
So in need of personal fulfillment. And so at a loss for answers, even the right questions, that getting that next product, getting that next thing, grabbing onto something. I want a new car. I want a bigger house. I want something else.
I want to get that contract.
I want to get that contract. I want to get that person. The whole idea is to sort of reaching out for more to get your answers, to fulfill you, to go on to the next thing, the so-called yuppies, get the next possession.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it is. And let's change the fashion quickly enough so that you'll want the next trend, and you keep yourself running after trends, and while you're running after those trends, you're never looking back and saying, gee, the last one wasn't really very fulfilling. It didn't really make me feel good about myself or anything else, but I got to keep up with the next trend. There's no time to really think about that.
I need a bigger size
TV screen in order to be, you know, in vogue or whatever it is.
And that isn't working for people.
No.
What you find is that we don't live in a me-first universe. We live in an information universe. We are connected on some level. It is, in a way, too much for people to handle sometimes, all of the information that's floating out there. You tend to feel even smaller and more alienated, more alone. The computer revolution, this revolution, that information. God, what about politics? What about the meaning of life? How about making a buck? How about love and romance? How about the whole world? How about reading the newspaper? People don't even read the newspaper anymore, a lot of them. And the idea is not really a reaching out. It's to empower people. When people begin to realize that, in fact, there is a whole other level of their being. There is a level, you can call it the psychic, a kind of connectedness, an ability to relate to the world in a less analytic way on some level. It's not that you throw out the analysis. It's that there is something in addition to that, some way of relating to the world that makes you not quite as alone, not quite as isolated, and that in some sense there's a kind of fulfillment of your own potential. And I'm not saying, and therefore, this is the answer to humanity. I'm saying that we need to learn to look at our own capabilities and who we are as people and stop looking to things to fulfill us outside of ourselves.
I'd like to apply that very specifically with what we've been talking about. If we take the view that we're nothing but our body and brain, then all we have is what's physical. So my happiness depends on getting physical things. And then, of course, your happiness depends on getting physical things. Well, suppose there's not enough physical things to go around. Well, then if you have them and I don't, I'm unhappy. And we have wars and so forth. But suppose we're really connected. Suppose we really come to know in some direct sense that we're connected. Well, then if you have something, I'm very happy. Because if you have it, we all have it. We can switch the whole basis of what makes happiness in life, this whole competitive greed thing, if we really come to understand the kind of real connections there are between us and share our happiness that way.
You touched upon a very key word that is happening, or that is changing, let's say, in our business community. And this is a very, I call it our system of providing goods and services. That's the way we all survive, doing that. The word was competitive. Now, it's one thing to be competitive if you're out in the jungle. But it's another thing to use that same competition if you're in the jungle of the high-rises of downtown Los Angeles and have the very same attitudes, where you win and the other guy loses, and the fact that his wife and children won't have any food or anything because you got the deal and he didn't, and too bad about him. And
I'd like to look at that concept of winning by getting the stuff,
right,
and the other guy losing, and where that's getting us. Did you see the cover of Newsweek a few weeks ago?
There are a lot of people competing for the same thing. There's only going to be one winner under that, so we have mostly losers then, don't we?
What we have is a tremendous, tremendous drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that about? People trying to make themselves feel good. People searching for some kind of inner experience. And these are not just people lying in some alley someplace on the skid row, but these are some of our listeners, professional people. Everyday people on the street.
Right.
The drug problem is so vast. As a psychologist, it really makes me wonder what is missing in our everyday lives
to cause us to go that way.
To cause us to go that way, to try to find an inner experience, something special, some either just relief from everyday life or some search for some kind of inner sensation that isn't being fulfilled in some other way. And why do that? Why not?
And particularly when they know it's self-destructive.
Well, maybe that's the idea.
And, right, that's the reason I said that. I mean,
but our physicalistic material culture is inherently destructive. Because, look, if we're nothing but our bodies and brains, there's one conclusion you can't escape, and that is that you're going to die. Mm-hmm. So since you're going to die, you better try and get your pleasures as much as you can now. And the devil take the hindermost. I'm afraid that comes out of this whole attitude, which is why we need a spiritual reawakening. But we can't have it the old way. We can't just suddenly say, okay, we'll believe something because it's called spiritual.
See, whenever you say spiritual, Charles, all at once people think in terms of religion and ritual and ceremony and rote.
And it scares them away because they say, who needs all that? That wasn't working for me either.
Well, I think inwardly most people, not all, but most people recognize that that doesn't do it.
Right. And I'm deliberately using the word spiritual instead of religion because I want to get away from
that. There is a profound difference.
There's a reality behind all those things that later became organized religions, but we mustn't confuse the inner reality with the outer forms, or then we get caught in the errors of the
world. Well, I think, you know, religions are going through the problem right now of there's nothing the matter with the religions, but there's a great deal of matter of what man has done to them.
It's interesting to look at what the major religions have said and to synthesize all of that down. And Damien Simpson, who a lot of your listeners may know, has a place where he has all of these listed.
Mm-hmm.
Love your neighbor, you know, treat another person as you would treat yourself. And it's all different
they all
religions.
Say the
they all say the same thing. Well, why are they killing one another?
Well, we know that religions are not working too well at this point in time. As we sit here right now, gentlemen, there are 38 wars being fought on the face of this planet, and man's inhumanity to man has never been at a greater level than it is at this moment. And it's not just on those battlefields. It's also right here in downtown Los Angeles in those shining towers down there.
Absolutely.
I'll share with you one of the reasons most religions aren't working, and this comes out of my investigation of altered states of consciousness over the years. The truth that lies behind religions, the spiritual truth, usually is only apprehended in some kind of altered state of consciousness, not in your normal state. If you get a religion that's lost the techniques for teaching people how to meditate, how to go inward, and instead just says, this is the doctrine and you better believe this or else, you get a religion that doesn't go to the core of people. And so naturally it doesn't work. That's why we're so interested in Eastern religions now, for instance, because they come with methods. They come with something to do. They tell you, in a sense, how to be spiritual and good instead of just that you ought to be spiritual and good. And this is one of the great hopes of our times, I think.
Well, they at least taught you how to meditate, but the Christian religion was also teaching you how to meditate. They just couched it in different language.
Well, if you get caught up in the ritual...
They lost the practice, though.
But they lost the practice.
If you get caught up in the ritual and the dogma, you must do this, you must light this candle three ways, do the ceremony, and you've emptied that of the experience, and you've really lost something, and you're just sort of walking in military fashion into the church, and what we need is a sense of the experience that doesn't come from drugs.
Well, you see, what
doesn't come from some...
What has happened here, Keith, by doing the ceremony and doing the ritual and doing the rote, we have done something else that most people like to do. We have relieved ourselves of the obligation of responsibility and order.
And we've emptied ourselves of the experience.
And therefore, we don't have to do anything. We can wear our little caps and we can play with our beads, and there we have done our good thing for the day, and we can go back being the primitive person that we were. But in our mind, we can say, hey, we've done all of the things. We went to church, but we did this.
Originally, the ritual was about creating an experience.
That's right. It was a focusing point.
It was a focusing point. And when people begin to work with their own capabilities again, with that side of their open minds, which is, let's say, intuitive, which is that part that we tend to deny in that hard analytic world that we live in, we get into that other side of ourselves. That's a very special thing, and you can do that without following some doctrine, some dogma. So looking at your own experience, opening up to that and its possibilities for you without having me or anyone else sit here and tell you what to make of reality. Opening up the experience is in itself a dramatic change, and people will decide what that means for them, and it's available to people in a very specific way. It's not something that we're talking about purely in the abstract. We have good scientific data showing that, in fact, everyday ordinary people, even a bunch of people who get together in a room for a workshop just to work on looking at certain parts of their own experience, not having a religious thing laid on them, it's just, here, let's work on learning how to use these abilities. Those kinds of people, all of us, can, in fact, develop their intuitive abilities, and by doing that, have a very special experience of themselves. It's empowering. We have enough power being taken away from us by the society at large, by all the confusion, by everything that we don't understand. We don't need to have psychic abilities, yet another area in which somebody else excels and I'm powerless. That's terrible. But in fact, it's not that way at all. In fact, people have this available to them in a very straightforward way, and that's the surprising thing in the research. And the implications of that are really tremendous for our understanding of human nature.
I like the way this conversation has gone, gentlemen. I really do. We've spent a little more time away from our audience than I usually do, but there are some inner ramifications about the importance of the scientific work that you're doing. Let's put one foot in reality, if we can, and another foot on this mystic thing we call spirituality and keep them together. And we have done that, and I want to get to the audience. Are you ready to talk to them out there?
They're just lined up
right here like crazy, ready to talk to each and every one of you. And let me give you the numbers. We're just started, and we're going to talk to Al. Al, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Bill. Welcome aboard, Charles and Keith. One little thing that helps me to get rid of the mental and physical confusions in society is a little buzzword I call MSP, meaning mental, spiritual, and physical. And, of course, the spiritual is lacking in all of us, and that helps me to keep on track. But the reason why I'm calling is we do a lot of practice with Rhine cards and remote viewing, and we have very good success. And I kind of feel...
Could you identify we?
Some of my employees, Bill, I also wanted to say that we're a local company that believes in giving to society first rather than taking and bumping up prices and so on.
You get five stars.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
You'll find out you'll be more successful because the guys that are trying to take instead of give are going to have to compete with your givers, and they will lose.
That's right. Giving is what God wanted us to do, and I don't feel I'm religious, but I do know that it comes back tenfold.
Sure feels better, doesn't it?
It sure does. And from our testing, Charles and Keith, I come to a theory that I really don't think there is any time. I think that this is an illusion just as the separation of individuals. What is your feeling on that with the experiments in the lab?
Well, clearly our understanding of our relationship with space and time is totally incomplete. When people can describe in very, very accurate detail something that will happen to them or to some other person in the future, even miles and miles away, there's no way that they could have known that information. That really throws some real confusion into what we thought we knew about time. We thought that the future hadn't happened yet, and there is no way to get information about something that hasn't happened, theoretically. And yet you see people describing time and time again in the laboratory events that seemingly haven't occurred. Now, what does that mean?
Right.
Does it mean that...
Oh, it's a very simple thing.
Oh, it's a very simple thing. Well, does it mean that somehow or other something very strange happened there in nature? I don't think so. I think what happened there is that we don't see things the way they are. And occasionally, the way they are kind of peeks through into our experience. Nothing strange happened there in nature. It's just that we don't always see it the way it is.
Well, I say simple, that's not true. It's a natural thing.
that's...
Because it isn't simple.
That explains it.
But there's a thing, Al, known as the space-time continuum that the physicists are working with all of the time. And we have found that we can indeed, in physics, break down or alter that space-time continuum.
Exactly. It's like the clock that man has made for us, the recent clock. But what happened with the Aztec people? And they were able to manage, and they had a different way of time.
You know, I love clocks. I collect them. I love clocks because, for me, they are one of the ultimate symbols
of man's biggest mistake.
Of man's confusion.
Exactly.
Well, now let me put in a good word for clocks here. Clocks are real handy for getting to your next appointment.
Absolutely.
Clocks represent a certain kind of psychological time that works very well for a lot of ordinary physical processes. But Keith put his finger on it, Al, you know. We don't really understand time. This precognition stuff in ESP is the big reminder
that we don't know anything about time. The mind can reach into the future sometime. We have no way of understanding that at present, so it should serve to remind us a little bit of how little we know, keep us humble and open-minded to look for it.
Now, I'll tell you something I've never told anybody before, but we've been experimenting with a device that breaks down the space-time continuum. And one of the...